You're listening to Aperitivo, first broadcast on the 23rd of October 2013 on Monocle 24. Aperitivo, brought to you by The Glenlivet. Hello from Midori House in London and welcome to Aperitivo, coming to you live from Studio One and from just down the road at the Monocle Cafe here in London. I'm Emma Nelson. On today's show, we assess the future of hard news. As tech giants play an ever more prominent role, will accuracy and impartiality be sacrificed?
I think the problem is that even for the biggest news outlets, that they resort to some fairly simple narratives because it's easier to tell the story, it attracts readers and viewers, and it makes up for not actually being able to get what's happening on the ground.
Then, was Obama a time waster when it came to Syria? One critique claims the president did all he could to avoid making a decision. John Owen and Stuart Purvis will tell us more. And with Netflix going global, Peter White from Broadcast looks at what's next. All that plus coffee, conversation and Danish design at the Monocle Cafe. That's Aperitivo with me, Emma Nelson, right now. So, lots coming up in the next hour here on Aperitivo. But before that, here's David Spencer with the latest news.
Thank you, Monocle 24 News. I'm David Spencer. Russia has dropped piracy charges against 30 people involved in a Greenpeace protest over Arctic oil drilling. The activists, who protested at an oil platform last month over claims the operation is damaging the environment, had faced piracy charges which carry a maximum jail sentence of 12 years. But the investigative committee in Russia says they will now face the lesser charge of hooliganism. A Chinese newspaper has pleaded for the release of an investigative reporter arrested by police last week. The state-run New Express tabloid printed a front-page commentary begging police to free Chen Yongzhou under the headline, "Please release him." He was detained after writing more than a dozen stories criticising the finances of a major state-owned construction equipment maker. India and China have signed 9 agreements aimed at boosting bilateral relations between the two. That includes an agreement on border defence cooperation, which follows a standoff earlier this year along the Himalayan border. It's seen as a way to break decades-old stalemate on overlapping claims to long stretches of the Himalayas. Indian Prime Minister Manmohan Singh signed the agreements on a visit to Beijing.
Premier Li was receptive to my concern about the unsustainable trade imbalance between our two countries, and we have agreed to explore avenues to bridge this gap. We are taking forward the suggestion made by Premier Li in New Delhi for a Chinese industrial park to act as a magnet for Chinese investments in India.
Italian ex-Prime Minister Silvio Berlusconi has been ordered to stand trial for the alleged bribery of a senator. He's accused of paying the left-wing senator €3 million to defect to his party in 2006 and help bring down the government. The senator was sentenced to 20 months on Wednesday at a plea bargain hearing in Naples. Berlusconi has been embroiled in a number of trials and says he's the victim of a campaign by the judiciary. He has denied any wrongdoing in this case. The Vatican has suspended Germany's so-called luxury bishop after concerns were raised about his lavish spending. Bishop Franz Peter Tepartz van Elst of Limburg has acquired the nickname of the Bishop of Bling after he spent some €31 million on his residence. Vatican journalist Marco Politti says Pope Francis has acted swiftly but not unfairly.
The Pope wants to give every accused person also the possibility to have a fair trial. And so the Pope is waiting for the results of the inspection commission which has been created by the German Bishops' Conference.
A federal judge is hearing arguments as to whether the city of Detroit should be granted protection from its creditors. With $18 billion of liabilities, Detroit's case is the biggest municipal bankruptcy filing in US history. Union and pension fund representatives oppose the bankruptcy, claiming that city officials haven't properly negotiated with creditors. They will also argue that Detroit is not bankrupt and has assets that it could sell to raise money. That's the latest news on Monocle 24.
Thanks, David. You're listening to Aperitivo here on Monocle 24.
From London
to New York
to Tokyo to Buenos Aires
to Zurich to Hong Kong
to Toronto
to Berlin
to Tel Aviv
to Amsterdam.
All around the world, this is Monocle 24.
The time here in London is 18.05, it's 13.05 in New York, and we're looking at the media for the first half of today's show. We'll be talking about the dangers of bitching about your boss on the internet in a moment, but first, BuzzFeed styles itself as the site that offers the hottest, most social content on the web. It's taking on hard news, and for some time it's been making its mark as a growing source of serious stories. But now it's opening an investigative unit headed up by the Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist Mark Schuss. It's a brave, but perhaps not entirely unsurprising move as a tech giants quietly go about becoming the new news outlets. Well, joining me here in the studio with their take on these developments is John Owen. He's chairman of the Frontline Club here in London and professor of international journalism at City University. And also Stuart Purvis, author of the new book, When Reporters Cross the Line, The Heroes, the Villains, the Hackers and the Spies. Also, he works at City University here in London. Welcome both to the programme, gentlemen. John, let's begin with you. As a man who obviously has to keep very much across developments in international journalism. When did BuzzFeed first come on your radar?
Well, BuzzFeed, you know, is one of those sources that I know not as much about as I would think I should. You know, it's one of those that has kind of crept up on me. I just found it's being referred to more and more. It's broken more and more stories. It's cited more and more frequently. But it's something for me that has kind of taken me by surprise. In this latest development really surprised me.
It took me by surprise as well, actually. I think we were discussing before we came on air, we just said, what was the last big story that BuzzFeed broke? And we said, okay, this is Glenn Greenwald leaving The Guardian.
That's exactly it.
But it was like, oh, it came from BuzzFeed. Were you taken by surprise by BuzzFeed, Stuart?
Yes, although it just either by coincidence or by design, this is the latest in what looks like a trend of the people who were the disruptors, who are the disruptors of the news business, becoming the saviours of the news business. Because obviously we've had the news that the man behind eBay, Pierre Omidyar, is going to start out with Glenn Greenwald, yeah. a big business. We also had already, of course, Jeff Bezos of Amazon buying the Washington Post. In fact, Omidyar says he got the idea for starting his own business when he saw he was interested in the Washington Post as well and didn't get it, so I thought, in which case I'll start my own. So, I mean, it's an extraordinary change. There is a kind of history of philanthropy in American journalism, but is this philanthropy? And is this ProPublica, for instance, the site that the guy who's going to work at BuzzFeed,
they really all came from the Wall Street Journal. That's where all of these guys defected from when Murdoch bought it.
Right.
Which leads me to ask the question, how much does traditional media actually underpin all this?
Well, they had to come from somewhere. I mean, so I think the heavy hitters, the people who are doing the serious content journalism, are defecting for big money. I mean, I think that's, if you're looking at what's going on in terms of these startups, if you've got Omidyar putting up $250 million, he can pick off a Glenn Greenwald. He can go after Jeremy Scahill at The Nation. And the other thing he's saying is, I really understand that plane tickets matter. So he's going to travel people to these stories.
You mentioned that they all have to come from somewhere. Let's hear the opinion of Scott Lucas. He isn't, by training, an academic. He's professor of American and Canadian studies at the University of Birmingham. But he, as a sideline, started up a website called EA Worldview. It started its life as Enduring America, which was initially a sort of a viral critique of American foreign policy. It then styled itself as being the only forum of any interest to anybody, it said, about goings on in the Middle East, with the focus on Iran and Syria in particular. Before we came on, Scott explained to us the challenges of breaking news on the internet in this day and age without the support of traditional journalists.
In some ways, there's this vast new opportunity through the diversity of sources that are out there. You know, we're no longer in a traditional reporting or journalism model in that you've got eyewitness accounts that come much quicker to us from, you know, through social media. You have citizen journalists, you have activists, you have NGOs, as well as state media, who are all, you know, trying to put information out. So it's not a shortage of information. But there's two things. One is that is the question of reliability, which you'll know well. And the second is, of course, that in certain cases, let's take Assyria, or until recently, let's take Iran, that there will always be attempts to basically limit this flow of information or to choke it off. And so in Syria right now, it's a much bigger challenge to really get a true picture of what's happening there, simply because a lot of the field journalists no longer go into the country. A lot of the citizen journalists have died or have fled the country. Some of the activist networks have been forced to curtail their activities. And so it's a lot harder work. The story just doesn't present itself to you. And what happens is, I guess to my distress, is that when that challenge comes up, the problem isn't the old one, which is, oh, you have professionals in the mainstream media and you have, you know, those who aren't professional. I think the problem is that even for the biggest news outlets, that they resort to some fairly simple narratives because it's easier to tell the story, it attracts readers and viewers, and it makes up for not actually being able to get what's happening on the ground. So in the case of Syria, for example, one of the simple narratives is Assad is winning. Another one is that the extremists are dominating the insurgency. Neither of those stories is true. I mean, there's elements of both stories that you could talk about, but overall, no, those are like sweeping. This is like a shorthand for what we think is happening, which doesn't begin to get to this patchwork, this complexity of what is actually occurring.
Scott Lucas from EA Worldview laying out a whole raft of problems with faced by websites such as his trying to report the news. Let's turn to you, Stuart. One of the things that he seized on immediately was the idea of reliability when it comes to the likes of citizen journalists and what have you. How much do you think the likes of BuzzFeed is actually contributing to problems or solutions to this?
I'm struck by the fact that brands that come almost from nowhere can establish reliability and reputation surprisingly quickly, probably with a couple of exclusives that turn out to be true. If you look at the website and the TV service TMZ in the States, which specializes in show business celebrity, remember they broke the news effectively of Michael Jackson's death. From that moment on, they were treated as a serious source, even though their record may have been unreliable. You know, I think there's a simpler explanation for what we've just been talking about here. It's about that, you know, I used to run a fairly big news organization called ITN in Britain, and we were sometimes told by consultants that news was now a commodity. You could buy it by the yard. You can buy it from the agencies. You can buy it from broadcasters. What these people are about is exclusivity. It's about investigative journalism that tells you something. In other words, they're trying to create a non-commodified news. And that, you know, I think there's an interesting business case for that. I can't, who knows whether they're going to make money out of it. But I've been studying recently that the ratings for current affairs programs in the UK. Now, about 5 years ago, everyone thought they would go out of business. But they've all remodeled themselves around investigative journalism. And actually, their ratings have leveled off and in some cases increased. So I think there is an audience for this kind of news, but it's expensive news. And that's why these guys are actually investing so much money in it.
And I also think that the brand will have to be established. The reason people watch these programs like Dispatches and Panorama is because they believe in the output.
Yeah.
These new outlets are going to have to prove themselves. Yeah. And the question will remain, can they take the heat? They're not used to having the heat. Jeff Bezos is not used to having the heat. The man who runs eBay, how will he feel when those investigative reporters start turning their guns on interests that he may have? You know, Catherine
Or
Graham,
indeed, when governments start when turning
governments
it on
start
proprietors.
Looking at their tax status or start to make threatening noises, will they have the courage to stand the course the way traditional publishers have, the way ITN did with you when you were in the middle of your huge controversy in Bosnia? What used to happen with me at CBC, that will really... really be the challenge.
Do you think, though, that given, I'm just thinking about the past 12 months and the effect on the BBC, and I'm also thinking of what happened with Hutton a decade ago with the BBC, there was an absolutely perceptible chilling effect on dangerous reporting, especially within the BBC. The whole top-down messages saying, you know, must be from two single sources, you must be able to stand up in court and, you know, reveal your sources to whoever, you know, is challenging you. There was a very obvious feeling from within the big bodies that they dare not stick their head up above the parapet. Last year, the whole problem with Savile, that again had a chilling effect on the big news outlets. Do you wonder whether the likes of BuzzFeed will actually become more relevant than the big news bodies in the next couple of years, Stuart?
Well, these people, these organisations will pick off single stories. I don't mean that I'm one story a week or something a year, but they will be focused. They are not trying, I'm guessing, because we still don't know a lot about some of these propositions, I guess they're not going to try and replicate the breadth of the news service offered by the traditional media. They're going to make their name, make their mark with a few investigations really well done that make them, get them talked about, get people to read their pages. So that, I guess, is the business proposition. I mean, the BBC was and continues in some ways to go through a series of own goals. So, you know, after the one you mentioned 10 years ago, a senior BBC executive, in fact, the acting director general, stood up and said, we're not going to do as much investigative journalism. And well, where that had a chilling effect, I think, fortunately, most people ignored him and just got on with it. But then, of course, we had the Savile affair where they did not get on with doing an investigation when they should have done. So there. But whether this was a result of pressure, I mean, we still don't actually know the full story why the BBC didn't actually run that Savile investigation, despite an inquiry. But we probably shouldn't get too carried away with the details of one institution. What's happening here? People were predicting the death of journalism, and we are seeing something that looks potentially like a lifeblood for journalism. We should give it a fair wind. But like John, I'm concerned about what will happen when the heat goes on these guys.
I'm also fascinated about the medium itself. We're told that people, eyeballs don't stay long on websites with long pieces. Now, we're talking about complicated investigative journalism being unleashed on the web at a time when people, you know, have little short stories on their smartphone devices and do they have the attention spans to grasp this? And how will a journalist like Glenn Greenwald and Scahill, who believe in detail and rigor and context, deal with, by the way, 100 words, that's a little long for your breaking investigative story on your smartphone.
Well, there's that wonderful documentary made inside the New York Times where the reporter's doing a long-form investigation and he informs the news desk of how long his piece will be. Some of us grew up believing that we told them what to do. The reporters defining their own lengths is a kind of new phenomenon.
And won't be tidy, go over 1 minute 30,
that's
if I remember.
Right.
I mean, John, you, Professor of International Journalism, do you get your students coming up to you saying, I don't want to work for the big outlets anymore, I want to start the equivalent of BuzzFeed?
Not at all. Not at all. I mean, I think, again, they still want to go where the stories matter. And in their own countries, remember, they're from all over the world, they still care about La Repubblica, they still care about El País, they still care about Le Monde, they care about the big outlets still and working for them. And when they meet, as they did this past week, a journalist like Haith Abdulahad of The Guardian, they want to be him. They see what he does to go get a story, the courage that he shows to get it. Don't dismiss still the power of legacy media.
When you're dealing, however, with citizen journalists or new fledgling journalists who desperately want to be the next name that breaks all the stories. What kind of duty of care do you think these outlets are actually offering to them?
That's a very good issue. Stuart and I have worried about that a lot when we ran our own news organizations. Will they really put the money there to train and equip and ensure freelancers?
That's the real issue. And I know it's the 10th anniversary now of a guy who was a student who worked for me during the Iraq War, on a casual contract when the war was over. He decided he wanted to go to Iraq as a freelance. And he talked to various news organizations, and they all said, look, we can't give you a contract, but if you get any interesting stories, let us know. And within a few weeks, he was dead, shot dead in the street in Baghdad. And nobody wanted to claim
Richard Wilde.
Richard Wilde, his name was. Nobody wanted to claim him as one of theirs. And frankly, I plead guilty to why I was one of the organizations that didn't claim him as one, though he had actually done a piece for us. So I think the big organizations, they don't want to commit, but they actually want to cover their backs if there's a big story. And that's where there's a potential exploitation of young people, I think.
Let's talk about you mentioned at the beginning, Stuart, the idea of the benevolent tech giant that swoops in. You mentioned Jeff Bezos, the founder of Amazon, who spent an enormous amount of money, but a drop in his personal ocean to buy the Washington Post. You said that they might be the saviours of this media, having actually pretty much ripped its heart out.
Yes, and I say that not in any kind of awe-struck way, but I've talked to somebody on the Washington Post about, well, what do you think Bezos is going to do? And this, as a distinguished journalist, what actually said, I think what's happened in the Washington Post is we've had a series of commercially conservative managers who were not prepared to take risks. And one of the risks they were not prepared to take was what's called cannibalization. In other words, if we do this bit, it'll hurt hurt what we do already. And he quoted Bezos as actually, if you look at the Amazon site, they're not selling just Amazon books, they're selling other people's, other merchants' books. And apparently it was Bezos who said, look, at the moment we're hiding away these other people on the site, let's put them in the center of the site. And people said, but that's competing with ourselves. And he said, sure, but as long as they're coming to our site to get their books, I don't care. And I just wonder if there's something there that, you know, news organizations have been so competitive with each other that, and so competitive internally about, you know, don't do that because that'll harm that bit. Somebody who might just kind of rip all that stuff up and try something different. Who knows what will happen? It might turn out to be a good thing.
In which case, I'm going to very briefly pin you down then. The BBC has been told it has to double its reach globally in the next decade. How much of a lesson can it learn from the likes of BuzzFeed?
Well, the BBC is about getting just more and more platforms in more and more countries. And since there are more and more platforms growing in more and more countries, I have a feeling they'll make that target. In fact, to be honest, if you look at their current rate of growth, if you just kept expanding at that rate, they would reach the target. So maybe it isn't such a tough target as it sounds. But it's based on actually sometimes quite traditional media like FM radio, for instance, in getting to more and more people.
We were just talking before we came on about how small the audiences are for international broadcasters in a place like the United States. Al Jazeera America, its top show, I was reliably told, is something like 54,000. Now, that's after all that incredible promotion in a country of over 300 million. That's not a big audience.
They have some growing to do. John Owen, Stuart Purvis, do stay with us. You're listening to Aperitivo.
The Glenlivet is the original Speyside single malt whiskey, and since 1824, its flavour has defined the region. Join master distiller Alan Winchester to determine the future of this historic distillery. Three new whiskies will set sail around the world, and members of the Guardians of the Glenlivet are invited to decide which will become the Guardians chapter. To discover more and write the next chapter of the legacy, join the Guardians of the Glenlivet.com. The Glenlivet, the single malt that started it all. Enjoy responsibly.
Join Monocle's editors every weekday at 8 a.m. for The View from Midori House. We'll be setting the day's agenda with special guests in the studio and from our bureaus around the world.
The opposition needs to identify the key message to deliver to their niche. And their niche is the 60% of the population who's voting for Korea right now.
We'll check in with our editors on the road, whether they're snowbound or sun-kissed. And of course, we'll still have the focus on music, media and the arts that you've come to expect. That's Midori House, every weekday at 8 a.m. London time.
It's 8:22. No, I'm lying to you. It's nearly 8:23 here in London. I'm joined by John Owen, chairman of the Frontline Club here in London and professor of international journalism at City University. And also next to me, Stuart Purvis, author of the new book, When Reporters Cross the Line, The Heroes, the Villains, the Hackers and the Spies. We were talking a little bit about a moment ago about the way that the media is going. Let's turn to a story which dominated the world's media a couple of weeks ago, but sort of went away again. It consumed the world. It was eclipsed, however, by the government shutdown. We all watched as President Obama squirmed over which path, of course, to take on Syria. When evidence emerged of the Assad regime using chemical weapons against its own people, Obama's red line was crossed, yet he hesitated. And ultimately, he had the decision over military action taken out of his hands. Well, an article in the New York Times catalogues the time Obama took in his deliberation, and it accuses him of being a time waster. John Owen, let's start with you. When you watched Obama's very, very public and lengthy deliberation, what was your reaction to it?
Well, I think you have to put it again, like any good journalist does, in context. I mean, why wouldn't he deliberate? After all, he became president because he promised to keep America out of another Iraq. And yet he ended up committing to Afghanistan. He's fulfilled his promises to get out of both countries. And along comes yet another Middle East conflict. He's trying to introduce a universal health care plan. He's trying to do something about the deficit. And he's being pressured to take a decision that is momentous. That, and he's being told, even in this long piece in the Times, that even trying to impose a no-fly zone would require 70,000 personnel. That is still a big decision to make. So why wouldn't he take his time?
It is a huge decision. Yet for the whole of his first term, there was constant pressure on him being unable to make a decision, unable to try to commit onto anything internationally. Perhaps being awarded the Nobel Peace Prize before he'd even done anything was perhaps something that almost scared him off slightly. The hawks, and in fact the tone of the New York Times was suggesting that this wasn't a man who was taking his time to make a decision. This was a man who perhaps wasn't quite up to the job of being the leader of the strongest country in the world.
See, I reject that just absolutely. I see no plausible argument for that. I mean, if you look at the way things are unfolding, let's give it a little time. Let's see what happens with Iran. Let's see what happens post-Afghanistan. And Syria, there is much more of an argument. Did he miss the opportunity to intervene when he might have supported a plausible opposition? But the one thing I'll say about this piece, and I look at the journalism of this piece, you find me very many on-the-record sources. There is a lot of score settling by past administrative people who are quoted. And the New York Times has been under criticism by its own public editor for anonymous sources. I counted at least a half a dozen of anonymous sources. I've got them all in ink here. I can't find on the record people willing to stand up and say, the reason I'm opposed to Obama and what he's doing is because of and who I am. That's a very serious journalistic breach, I think.
Stuart, one of the standout snippets from this article, which I think it says run around the world, which was describes Obama's body language when he's being told about the general, he's being given the progressively worse and worse story about the situation in Syria. It says current and former officials say his body language was telling. He often appeared impatient or disengaged while listening to the debate, sometimes scrolling through messages on his BlackBerry or slouching and chewing gum. Now, before we came on air, there was a discussion on the editorial floor. Some colleagues were saying, it sounds as if he's disinterested. I thought that's a lawyer being very, very clever and thinking and actually giving the impression of being in control. What were your thoughts?
Well, if you look back at the way American presidents have handled crises before, there seems to be as many people who weren't in the room at the time as there were people who were in the room. So there's a whole history of people walking in and out of the room and then coming back in the room and saying, what have we decided? And the answer is, we're at war. Fine, OK, we're at war. So do we want that kind of president, or do we want one who takes his time? Now, the whole protocol of whether you look at your mobile phone during a meeting has become a kind of big issue to me. I've chaired meetings where people are sitting there looking at their phones, and I have to say, when you're in the chair, it's mildly annoying.
But have you ever been in a meeting where you're deciding whether to take military action on a huge scale?
All I say is that it's something that some people react to and some people don't. I mean, there's another story where I think early in his presidency, he invited a lot of people from Congress to come to an event. I think it was like the Super Bowl or something, and he was more interested in the Super Bowl or the sporting event than he was in talking to them. Now, that became a missed opportunity. Why hadn't he networked all those people? Why had he been more interested in watching television? So, you know, I suppose sometimes there are just human frailties that people have, which your enemies are going to pick up on.
John.
And again, I think, you know, it's really, we need to know, you know, why did people not go on the record? And that's also an interesting case, because the people won't go on the record because the Obama administration has been so tough to try to silence journalists and their sources. So that's the other explanation maybe why you have so much deep information about the Obama administration. The other thing only to say that note that he was on a BlackBerry. That would not be said 2 years later. he got rid of his BlackBerry. He'd be on his iPad or something. I bet Rim must read that and just weep.
Yeah.
Let's move on briefly to a story talking about social media and its use inside the White House. A gentleman called Joffe Joseph, whose name was pretty much unknown to everybody, but what he was saying wasn't. He was working for the National Security Council Nuclear Non-Proliferation Team at the White House. It turns out he has been the source of such tweeted gems, and I quote, "Was Huma Abedin wearing beer goggles the night she met Anthony Weiner?" Of course, he's referring to the former New York mayoral candidate and his wife, a former aide of Hillary Clinton. Mr. Joseph has been sacked, and he's been apologising for his so-called mean-spirited and inappropriate comments. Stuart, should we be sorry for Mr. Joseph, or is this fair dues for a bad employee?
Well, I think it's fair dues somebody got caught, but it connects back to what was John said. The Obama team have been after this tweeter for some time, And frankly, they weren't worried that he was calling people fat and ugly, although, you know, that was a pretty stupid thing to do. They were upset because he was criticising Hillary Clinton over the Benghazi Libya incident. So they wanted to know, who the hell is this person who is who's clearly being briefed and is clearly tweeting against us? But the story gets better because I think that even today it's been revealed that he had another Twitter account in the name of DC Hobbyist, in which he shared reminiscences with escort agencies where he had actually been doing business with them. So you've got this guy who is sitting in the White House, tweeting about national security, tweeting about his love life, even though I think his wife works in another part of a, she works for a congressional commissioner committee. Yeah, so it kind of just shows you, you know, how people can completely lose the plot in terms of getting found out.
How different, though, John, is this from someone from the government having a quiet drink with a reporter at the end of the day?
Well, it's not going all over the world. A quiet drink with a reporter is not being read by the entire world online.
Not perhaps until the next morning.
Not until the next morning. No, I think, I mean, if this guy does have security obligations and he's violating them, then you can understand why they'd want to kind of silence him. But I think what must be fascinating is people were probably in his own department and colleagues reading him for information about their own part of the White House.
I don't think anybody else was until now.
Yeah, I noticed he didn't have many followers.
No.
But we're all having a good look now, I'm sure.
Look for his book.
It's great fun. It's great fun. Thank you very much indeed, both gentlemen. John Owen, chairman of the Frontline Club here in London, professor of international journalism at City University, and Stuart Purvis, author of the new book, When Reporters Cross the Line, The Heroes, the Villains, the Hackers, and the Spies. Plenty still to come in the second half of today's Aperitivo. We'll head to the Monocle Cafe to talk Danish design, and we'll preview what's coming up on today's Globalist Asia and Monocle Daily.
Vanuit London, dit is Monocle 24.
London으로부터 Monocle 24입니다.
Op London, to my Monocle 24.
Fra London, dette Monocle 24.
From London, this is Londres.
Hollanda.
London.
London으로부터
Hong Kong.
Hong Kong.
Zurich.
London. London.
This is Monocle 24.
But the time here in London is fast approaching 32 minutes past the hour, so it's time to get the latest from David.
Thank you very much indeed. Russia has dropped piracy charges against 30 people involved in a Greenpeace protest over Arctic oil drilling. The activists could have faced a maximum jail sentence of 15 years. They'll now face the lesser charge of hooliganism. Former Italian Prime Minister Silvio Berlusconi has been ordered to stand trial for corruption. He denies claims that he paid a left-wing senator €3 million to defect to his party in 2006 and help bring down the government. A Chinese newspaper has published a front-page appeal for the release of one of its journalists after he was detained by police. The New Express journalist had published several stories alleging corruption at a large construction company. India and China have signed 9 agreements aimed at boosting bilateral relations between the two. That includes an agreement on border defence cooperation, which follows a standoff earlier this year between the two along the Himalayan border. Residents in the Australian state of New South Wales have been told they can return to their homes after the threat of bushfires was averted, but the state's fire commissioner has warned that fresh challenges lay ahead in the coming days amid unfavourable conditions. Guards at a prison in Moldova say they've caught a cat that was being used to traffic bags of drugs on its collar. The animal was spotted with a suspicious purple collar with two little bags attached to it, which were found to contain a green substance of plant origin with a distinctive cannabis smell. Those are the latest headlines on Monocle 24.
Thanks, David. Why was it that I immediately thought that if the cat were to be carrying cannabis, the clothes or the colour that it would be wearing would be purple? I don't know. There's just an inherent connection. I have no idea why. You would never get a cat with a navy collar or a white collar.
No.
Or a blue collar. Blue collar worker cat.
But the fact you thought of purple means that
hippie
that
cat
was immediately suspicious.
Totally.
So you should have gone with, you know, a yellow collar.
Totally.
Wouldn't have raised suspicions. It was a basic error.
The little bags, they probably had tassels on them. They might even have been tie-dyed. David, thank you very much indeed. The time is just coming up to 34 minutes past the hour. Welcome back to Aperitivo. Time now to head to the Monocle Cafe on Chiltern Street, just down the road, for coffee and a chat. On today's show, we meet the graphic designer Peter Saville. He's written a foreword for a new book published by Prestel. It's called Interwoven, Quadrat Textile and Design, and it comes out on Monday, the
the 28th of October. That's next week. It's about the pioneering Danish textile company Kvadrat, from its founding in the late 1960s and its Scandinavian roots to its role as a global force in the world of design. I'm delighted to say David Pleasant is talking to Peter down at the cafe now. David.
Thanks, Emma. And yes, welcome Peter Saville and also Jane Withers, who was also involved in the book. Thank you for coming along to the Aperitivo and joining us here in the cafe. If we could start, we are mulling over this wonderful book. Tell us a little bit about what the idea was, what you wanted to express about this this company, this Danish firm that many designers will be familiar with, but perhaps people outside of the design community might not know quite so much about. What's the story?
Kvadrat are one of those what's kind of industry secrets, because they make fabric, they make material, rather than a direct retail product. They're not a kind of everyday household name, but within the design industry they are, because they're probably the most successful, the most influential, the most innovative of all of the fabric companies in Europe, and supply the fabrics for most of the contemporary design market. And, you know, they're a lovely company based in Denmark, kind of strangely modest in kind of by modern standards, modern terms. And they became a name that everybody knew. But people didn't really know that much about the company itself. So, I mean, I started working with them nearly 10 years ago, and I didn't know the name either. I didn't know the company. I knew the products. I knew what they did. And I'd often wondered where it came from. And then, you know, getting to know the company, I found out. So almost from the very beginning of at least my relationship with Kvadrat as a kind of communications consultant, somebody, you know, to discuss things with, it's kind of evident that something like a book would be great to do one day. And the last, you know, kind of, it really picked up pace the last two or three years, and, you know, finally it exists. And is an insight into, you know, a fairly rare company, and a very generous company by modern standards.
And that comes across in a lot of the text and the story that's told in the book, is that kind of human quality to the company. And you've mentioned before the fact that one of the factors that make Kvadrat so unique is perhaps that human involvement and the kind of the ability for the directors, the people behind Kvadrat, to have complete, you know, free reins over what they ended up producing. They weren't those kind. I mean, you've often critiqued a lot of the what you probably see as the malign forces in the design world. Yes. Can you tell us a bit about what sets Kvadrat aside, apart?
There's a, you know, an organic quality from, you know, from the product they make and the materials they work with, to, in a way, the kind of the fabric of the company itself. It is a family business, founded 50 years ago plus, has remained a family business, is profitable through the quality that it maintains, but not in any way greedy. Kvadrat seem to be happy being who they are and evolving at what we might understand as a kind of a natural pace rather than an accelerated pace. So they do things because they can, and they do things because they actually want to, not because of profit targets or other agendas. So you find yourself working in a very real, transparent, authentic situation. And it's authenticity in business, which so many companies wish to project but don't really live by, that's, you know, sets Kvadrat apart. I mean, they are a very genuine group of people to work with.
And if we talk about the products, what they... What resulted in this process, this unique collaboration and the influences into the firm? Jane Withers, creative consultant and creative director, You've contributed to the book by way of an essay focusing on colour since the 1960s. Tell us about some of the colours, some of the those products, those unique. You know, what kind of things did they result? You know, what are the celebrated kind of quadrat symbolic colours that we can talk about?
Well, I think when quadrat began, they founded in 68, and that was the time of Werner Panton and so on, and the pop explosion in the world in design following art. And after the sort of good taste of natural Danish colour before that, and Finule and so on, they literally gave the fabric and the colour for the new pop design. I think it's been, they've kept up that association in 50 years. I mean, it's gone up and down over the years, but working with really influential collaborators, Nana Ditzel, Giulio Ridolfi, Finn Scott, now the Borrelex, Peter Saville, Oliver Eliasson, they keep this really wide-ranging group of people who I think pull them forward, and that's what's made them exciting, because it's not a given path necessary. So they're constantly trying to think at a time when often fabrics have gone out of fashion in the design world, how to use them more imaginatively.
And I mean, if we look through some of the images that I kind of dread using this word, but there is something of the iconic design kind of classics about it. Perhaps try and paint a picture of the kind of images, the kind of designs that we're looking at and that you discuss in the book.
Well, I think, you know, what's most interesting is the way the colours have actually been used in the real world. I mean, you have Nana Ditzel did these wonderful, it's called, I think, sort of bright pastels. She took it from the bright colours of pop into a softer colouring.
Wonderful colours, wonderful pictures, and Peter Saville, a wonderful book. Thank you both very much for joining us, the legendary Peter Saville and Jane Withers. And that's it for now. Thank you very much, and back to Emma.
Thank you very much indeed, David. That was David Pleasant with the graphic designer Peter Saville and Jane Withers too. You're listening to Aperitivo. Up next, we look at the future of Netflix.
Inspiring the likes of Charles Dickens since 1824, the Glenlivet may be the definitive Speyside single malt whiskey, but that's just one chapter of the story. Master distiller Alan Winchester is inviting the Glenlivet's global community of whiskey connoisseurs to help curate the flavours of their next limited edition whiskey, The Guardian's Chapter. To discover more, join the Guardians at theglenlivet.com. The Glenlivet, the single malt that started it all. Enjoy responsibly.
The entrepreneur seeks out the seers, the sages, and the successes of the business world. Every week, we take you on an hour-long tour to uncover the hidden, extraordinary, curious, and inspiring stories you won't hear anywhere else.
I don't see any borders between countries, if it's Japan, England, France. My approach is that I believe that people anywhere in the world, there are people who understand and appreciate it.
There's a push maybe that people want to have more of their stuff made locally because they know where it's coming from.
From the kiosk owners of Cairo to the coffee culture of Tel Aviv, from the beer brewers of Ghana to the piano makers of Greece. Intrigued? Well, tune in to hear how the best entrepreneurial minds tick, not just the ups and downs of the FTSE.
We didn't buy into a design studio or a commercial entity, we bought into a factory.
So, if you have an idea and want to drop that 9-to-5, you've just found your new business Bible.
That's The Entrepreneurs, premiering every Wednesday at 1900 hours UK time, in association with Pictet.
And a very warm welcome back to Aperitivo with me, Emma Nelson. Now, in the first half of today's programme, we discussed how the changing face of media is going to be perhaps revolutionising the way we absorb our hard news. Well, our focus on media continues, but in a different way. Netflix. It's been quietly taking money out of my account, and now it's taking over the world's viewing habits. It's brought us House of Cards, Breaking Bad, Orange is the New Black, pretty much anything half-decent in the last year. It's now popular. It's very popular, more popular, in fact, in the United States than HBO. So what does this say about our viewing habits? Well, joining us now on the line is Peter White from Broadcast Magazine. A very warm welcome to the programme, Peter. I kind of stumbled upon Netflix when I was shamed into not knowing what it was. I immediately signed up to it as a result. Where did it come from?
Well, it's been around for a number of years. It was largely in the States known as being a DVD supplier, whereby people rented DVDs by mail. But a few years ago, and this is sort of five onwards, it turned into a streaming service, and has been sort of quietly sort of taking all of the rights to all of the TV and movies that you want to watch and putting them online. And that's both in the United States. And then a couple of years ago, it started to move outside of the U.S. and started moving into the UK, into the Nordics, and across Latin America, and into a number of other territories. So it's sort of turned into this international, global behemoth of an online streaming service.
You made it sound incredibly simple there, making that quick jump from just streaming a few DVDs to then taking over the syndication of lots of programmes such as House of Cards. How on earth did it do that?
There's sort of two different things there. I think from turning from a DVD supplier into a digital supplier, they had a few problems, but ultimately they were talking to the same people, so doing those deals wasn't that dissimilar. Turning into an original producer of content with shows like House of Cards and Arrested Development and such, that was a bit more difficult. That was a sort of move a couple of years ago where they decided that the rights to some of the shows that they wanted were either becoming too expensive or they couldn't get them. So they thought, hey, well, we'll just make this ourselves. And they went in pretty big when they did it. You know, they brought in big names from the movie world and big directors and actors to do this.
What do the seasonal pitches now look and feel like when the likes of Netflix comes along? I mean, how scared are the traditional outlets such as HBO?
HBO is a bit different. I think the rest of the broadcasting landscape is terrified of Netflix for what they'll do to their business, because they're snapping up some of the best talent. They're getting some of the best ideas. I mean, if you look at some of the things that they've got, you know, whether it's House of Cards, which would have fit perfectly on HBO or any other sort of premium network. And then they've got things like Orange is the New Black, which was a bit of a silent hit, whereby no one really expected it to do that well, but it's turned into this really popular female drama. And then they're serving all sorts of other territories. You know, that Hemlock Grove is a horror thing for sort of youth and teens. And then they're moving into other worlds. I mean, they've even got some of their own kids stuff now. So, I mean, they're really becoming a big player in this game. They're really changing things in terms of production and original content.
They are a great big player, but there's always one thing that frustrates me, at least, and perhaps I'm the only one in the world whose internet connection goes down. And there's nothing more that I hate than being halfway through an incredibly good programme and then the little spinning wheel occurs, and then that's it for me and my viewing. How does Netflix get around that now?
I'm not sure they do. I remember watching the finale of Breaking Bad on the Monday that it came out in the UK, which was a sort of hours after it debuted in the States, and me and some friends were sitting around a big TV and were halfway through the sort of last episode, and that exactly happened to you. I think that's just one of the things that will change, and as internet gets better and broadband speeds improve, I think it won't be an issue in a few years. So they're almost dusting off their shoulders.
Do you think it won't be an issue in a few years? Because by all accounts, it signed a deal with Virgin Media here in the United Kingdom to give it access through their set-top boxes. Can you, in about 5 or 6 years' time, see someone, the big television people, how did I describe that? That was incredibly clumsy, but I think you understand what I mean, actually buying out Netflix and restoring it to traditional television?
I'm not sure I can see anyone buying it out. Probably I almost see it the other way around, that Netflix might be the one buying. But yeah, they're ultimately looking to be in your front room. And that sort of means now being on your connected box. So Virgin is quite cannily done a deal whereby that you can just watch it through your cable platform. And I think that Netflix would be keen to do other deals like that. But ultimately, I think when we all have internet-connected TVs and we're watching things through Apple TV and all sorts of other devices, I think you won't notice much difference from BBC One, Sky or Netflix in the future.
Peter White from Broadcast on the future of Netflix. Thank you very much indeed. It's time now for a little bit of music. House of Cards is one of Netflix's biggest hits. So here's Radiohead with House of Cards. from 2007 in Rainbows. It was the album. The band, of course, is Radiohead, and the track was called House of Cards. You're listening to Aperitivo here on Monocle 24. We're fast approaching the end of the programme, but before we go, let's have a look at what's coming up later on today on Monocle 24. I'm joined by Daphne Denis, producer of The Globalist Asia, and Annabelle Bly, who's heading up the Monocle Daily. Right, ladies, who's going first?
I guess I should go first. Of course, the Globalist Asia.
You're up
after
first. Ms. Denis, what are we talking about?
We will lead with the agreement between China and India on having a border, at least. So obviously this rings back to a long rivalry between the two countries. They can't agree where one ends and the other begins. And we will be asking a defence expert in New Delhi if he thinks that this agreement is going to lead us anywhere.
There is this amazing no man's land. It's not technically a no man's land, but there's this strange area that the Chinese started putting tents up there earlier on this year, and that was considered to be a territorial spat. This has been going on, what? There was a brief war in 1962 among this. So who are we going to be talking to about how important this is going to be?
Well, it's Commodore Uday Baksar, who's obviously the authority on this in India. And his main point is that the big problem is that there's no actual border. No. So obviously, how do you do this?
It's also a place that no one ever goes to, apart from the Chinese army and their tents, and the Indians as well. I think every time we've discussed this on Monocle 24, we have always shrugged our shoulders and said, "What's the fuss?" But still, it's good to see that China and India, two great big trading partners, now suddenly diplomatically getting a little bit of common sense. What else is happening?
We'll also discuss quite a bold move by a Chinese newspaper asking for one of their journalists to be released. He's been held over an investigation on corruption and specifically one business in Guangzhou province. And the newspaper has made its front page demanding the journalist's release. And that's obviously quite a strong move in a country where that's not very well known for its respect for the freedom of expression.
Well, you have journalists in China having to be trained up to toe the party line. Who are we going to be talking to about the complicated nature of this route out of corruption that Xi Jinping is embarking upon, yet the fact that journalists are becoming slightly more relaxed when it comes to their self-expression?
We'll be talking to Gordon Chang, who's a Forbes columnist and specialises in China.
Thank you very much indeed. That's at what time? 2100 hours if
Absolutely.
You're in London. So that's 2100 hours if you are in Berlin. Annabelle Bly looking at me, ready and raring to go to tell us what's in the Monocle Daily.
Yeah, we'll be starting with asking the question of whether or not a city can file for bankruptcy. So Detroit, it's in court today discussing whether or not they can actually file for bankruptcy.
And who are we going to be talking to about that?
We will be talking to a reporter on the ground in Detroit to get the feeling of what's going on in the city, because obviously this will affect a huge number of people. But we'll also be talking to a lawyer and specialist in bankruptcy law to see whether or not this is actually possible.
Are we going to be arguing about whether a city itself should actually be obliged to file for bankruptcy, or whether, in actual fact, Detroit is putting up its hands in court and saying, yeah, we haven't got much money, but we are nonetheless solvent?
Yeah, well, we'll just be looking at what the trial actually entails. It started today, and there's a huge number of people protesting outside. It's going to go on for a few days. So we'll kind of be profiling the case and discussing what we can expect over the next few days.
Okay, thank you very much. Annabelle, what else is coming up?
We'll also be talking about the Arctic Council. We have a guest coming into our Toronto bureau to discuss Canada's chairmanship of the council, and that's something that you can also read about in the latest edition of Monocle magazine.
I was about to say, if you haven't already got a copy, it's got a very handsome dog on the front cover and some incredibly interesting articles, including one absolute exclusive scoop from our foreign editor, Steve Bloomfield, who went to Lapland, no doubt, and talked to the most famous man in the world. Annabelle and Daphne, thank you both ladies for coming in to talk to us. That's all we have time for today's Aperitivo. My thanks in particular to our special guests, John Owen and Stuart Purvis, who are my friends for the first half hour of today's programme. My thanks to our producer, Danny Jacopelli, researcher Maddie Arouge and Andrea Alarcon, and to our studio manager Chris Chilvers. Next up is The Entrepreneurs. We'll be finding out about Paris's burgeoning startup scene, and we'll get shown around a brand new bespoke cinema in West London that used to be home to the infamous Olympic Recording Studios.
There was always a sort of a passion project the plan is to try and do it well, and if by doing it well we'll make money, then fantastic, rather than it's got to be all about the money, and if it's done well, so be it.
Aperitivo will be back at the same time tomorrow at 1800 hours London time. But for now, me, Emma Nelson, and all the team here at Midori House, goodbye. Thank you very much for listening.
The Rolex Mentor and Protégé Arts Initiative sources young artists across seven disciplines and brings them together with artistic masters for a year of mentoring. For mentors, it's a year to share their passion and expertise. For protégés, it's a once-in-a-lifetime opportunity to observe and work alongside some of the world's greatest artists. For Rolex, it's a chance to ensure the world's artistic legacy is passed on to the next generation. 1 year can inspire a lifetime.